This is the New Nationalist Perspective with Dr. Tom Sunek, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Dr. Tomislav Sunek is a former professor, author, translator, and diplomat. Visit his website for interviews, essays, books, and more at tomsunek.info. And now here's your host, Tom Sunek.
Yes, Henry, I'm very pleased what you have said. So basically what you're suggesting is that this massive killing and the suffering as far as the ethnic Germans were concerned, the location, place, the killing fields were in ex-Yugoslavia. Am I correct?
That's right. That's where...
Well,
yeah.
And tell me, Henry, there are lots of questions we have here. But basically, look, what we want to distinguish here is the following. We are dealing with three different jurisdictions in 1946,
right.
We're dealing with Yugoslavia, which was put together from pieces, bits and pieces, from Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and so on, from Hungary itself and from Romania. And we are talking about, let's just recap it, 1.5 million ethnic Germans, civilians. And now, there's, as far as I know, to my knowledge, there are just probably a couple of dozens of thousands left all in this area. Could you explain that to our audience a little bit more in detail?
Well, we'll start with Hungary, the one I'm most familiar with. Can I do that?
Yes, in Hungary, there was about 500,000 ethnic Germans.
Right, about 250,000 of them were expelled according to the protocols established at Potsdam in 1945. I believe it was in August where the big three who met there called upon their expulsion. And so that took place between 1946 and 48. And when they ran out of room in Germany, the Hungarians and... the Potsdam people decided that they would let, I think there were about 200,000 who were left at that time, who were still living in Hungary.
What happened in Yugoslavia? The problem, it's so difficult to understand because Croatia had about 200,000 ethnic Germans. But let's just general, in 46, there was no more Croatia. There was unified Yugoslavia. But even prior to that, in 44, there were quite a few of civilians, German civilians from Croatia specifically, who left the country for Austria.
Right. That was, in 44 were the evacuations. There were organized evacuations taking the German population out of that area because they were endangered by partisan raids. In the rest of Yugoslavia... there was no planned evacuation until suddenly when Romania capitulated and suddenly the Red Army was entering Yugoslavia, and then they started to evacuate, except they didn't evacuate in the Banat. There was, quote-unquote, there had been a Führer order not to allow the German population to evacuate because that would scare the Hungarians into surrendering. And so they sacrificed the population living there. But in the Bačka, which is on the other side of the Danube, there were evacuation tracks. The important thing I have to emphasize, Dr. Tom, is that when we're now talking about the ethnic Germans in this area, we're talking basically about the elderly, women, and children, because the men had been taken into the armies and were not there.
Well, thank you for making...
And so when all of this comes, I have to constantly say, you're talking about women and children and the elderly. And they were placed in Yugoslavia There was this great big conference that Tito held, the AVNOJ. I think that's the technical monogram that I've seen for that. And this calls for the German population was that they were outlaws. They lived outside of the law. They had no legal rights. They were interned in camps. Many of the camps were their own villages. The able-bodied women primarily, again, in Christmas of 1945 until January, were taken to Russia, 17-year-old to 40 in some places, ended up in labor camps in Russia. And so you had the elderly and the children left behind who were then placed in camps. And they were called Vernichtungslager, extermination camps. And that has a whole horrendous history there. And, you know, I've spoken to people who were survivors, children, you know, 5 and 6 years old, where they tell you this story of how their mother was taken from them on Christmas Eve and how they were left all alone until somebody came to find them. And then they were put into a camp. And then when they were in these camps, not enough of them died, so they decided, well, we'll raise them as citizens of Yugoslavia. And so they put them in orphanages all around the country. And we estimate there were about 35,000 children like that who lost their identity. They were given new names. They could no longer, or weren't allowed to speak German. But fortunately, some of the older children, these were children 12 and under, managed to remember who they were and their origins were. And we were able, following the war, after in the 50s, maybe about 5,000 of these children recovered and reunited with their mothers or fathers. Usually the father had been a prisoner of war, ended up in West Germany. The mother, if she survived the labor camps in Russia, ended up in Germany as well. And so they would undertake this long, long process of trying to repatriate their children. So by the time it was all over, there were a few thousand of the Danube-Sweden population still living in Yugoslavia. But I think there are still some there today, isolated pockets. But then the Germans from Croatia who ended up in Germany and Austria, when the war was over, Tito said, come home. And the Austrians were only too, and the Germans were only too happy to send these refugees, you know, back home. Well, when they got back home, those who did do that also ended up in the camps, you know, and many of them died there as well.
Yep. Henry, I can hear you very, very well, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And believe it or not, it's very, very creepy for me. I have those creepy feelings because... let's just try to provide a larger picture for our audience. This is just the tip of the iceberg, what happened to civilian Germans after the Second World War in Eastern Europe. We are talking here about Silesia. I don't know how many folks know, and I don't want to hurt the feelings of our Americans who are of Polish ancestry. The Danzig or Gdansk was 90% German populated. Was a purely German city, that Kaliningrad or Königsberg, further up north, 1,000 kilometers from where I live, further north in the Baltics, was also, Immanuel Kant, a great philosopher, was born there. So basically, I don't want to talk now and philosophize, but basically, Mr. Fischer, we need to provide a larger picture. And I'm going to ask you a question, and I guess you certainly know the answer. Who gave the blessing for those mass killings and who actually condoned the communist killing fields in Tito's Yugoslavia in 45-46?
Well, who condoned it was all of the European powers. Like, nobody would accept a wonderful institution like the Red Cross. When the issue was raised about finding our children, they didn't want to do it because that would do something to their reputation and involvement with Tito's government, which at that time, you know, he was withdrawing from Stalin and all that kind of stuff. And so there were all these things at play that No, these are Germans. You don't deal with them. You know, mm-hmm. we were subhuman. There was this thing called collective guilt. That's what the phrase was in Hungary. Every man, woman, and child who is ethnically German or had a German name was guilty. And it was this mentality after the war, because of the atrocities committed by the Nazi regime, no question about that, the Holocaust, and all of those things. But it was condoned by the signers of the Potsdam Declaration. Harry Truman, you know, Clement Attlee, and Joseph Stalin. Churchill had been there earlier until, you know, he was no longer the British Prime Minister, and Roosevelt had died. You know, during that
Mr. Fisher, the reason I'm asking you that, I happen to be very much familiar with this chapter of history. And in fact, what prompted this interview was I received a deluge of emails from ethnic Germans as a follow-up to my piece that I published in the Occidental Observer, Race and Racism and then the End Times in Germany, which was quite scholarly, I should say. And I myself, as you know, I'm also an honorary member of Ethnic German Club here in Zagreb in Croatia. And this was actually the first foreign language I had to learn at school, but I'm not going to talk about myself. Basically, what we need to emphasize and tell our audience is that folks are completely ignorant. Students in the United States, and not just in the United States, but also elsewhere in Europe, of what really happened, and we are talking not about 1 million, but 13 million, even probably 14 million people who were ethnically cleansed, German ancestry. And I know it firsthand what happened to my German friends because some of their parents here in ex-communist Yugoslavia. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I certainly would suggest you once again do look up at the website www.dvhh.org, and please do look at Henry Fisher's book, Children of the Danube, a book where he recounts the sufferings, I mean, unimaginable suffering of the German people, German civilians. We are not talking about the soldiers. Why I'm telling you that, I'm not going to be explicit, folks, but listen, we hear about survivors on the daily basis, but we never truly hear the other side of the story. And there are some very good books on it, and I certainly would appreciate if you could contact Mr. Henry Fisher, Reverend Henry Fisher. Henry, please. You were born in Canada. At some point, you write that you were actually, despite the fact that you're a Canadian citizen, you were harassed. You were actually, well, harassed. You had some nuisances. You had some troubles with your schoolmates. Am I correct? What happened, actually, back there?
Oh, gee. That was during the war years. Yeah, I was. Mm-hmm. I started school in 1939 in September, just as the war broke out. The only language I spoke at that time was a German. So I learned English very quickly. But anyway, during that whole war experience, you know, I grew up in Canada and in Little Swabian, Hungary, 23 Oak Street in Kitchener, Ontario, because I lived in two worlds. The first generation knows what I'm talking about. When you go through the doors in one world, with one language, a set of values, traditions, and heritage, you go outside and you're exposed to an entirely different world and you have to find your place there. And of course, in the war years, you know, I was a little kraut on Oak Street. You know,
kraut, yes.
Yeah, that's...
Sure, I know.
Yeah, but, you know, and there was always this kind of pressure that I experienced, that in order to be a Canadian, I somehow had to become an Anglo-Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a long time to quote unquote come to terms with all of that, you know, and say, yeah, I am a Canadian. But that does not mean I in any way devalue my heritage or my ethnic origin, and I celebrate it. I passed on my traditions and my values to my children and now my grandchildren.
You know, Henry, thank you. Well, Henry, we'll just take a little break, and just before we take a break, let me again alert my audience to Henry Fisher, a great author of German ancestry, born in Canada, Canadian, and please, my dear guests, dear friends, look at his website, www.dvhh.org, dealing with the suffering of ethnic Germans in what was once communist Europe. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back. This was Tom Sunik, VOR.
We'll be right back with the New Nationalist Perspective. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The top American military officer says Afghanistan can be won, but it will likely take more U.S. troops.
It's very clear to me we will need more resources.
Joint Chiefs Chairman Mike Mullen told the Senate Armed Services Committee he doesn't know just how many the U.S. commander there will ask for. He says General Stanley McChrystal will make his request very soon. There are about 65,000 American troops there now. Some leading Senate Democrats are skeptical about sending more. The panel's chair says that should wait until larger numbers of Afghanistan's own forces are trained and deployed.
Providing the resources needed for the Afghan army and Afghan police to become self-sufficient would demonstrate our commitment to the success of a mission that is in our national security interest, while avoiding the risks associated with a larger U.S. footprint.
But his committee co-chair argued not sending enough combat forces would invite a rerun of mistakes made early in the Iraq War.
I've seen that movie before.
Another argument is only sending more trainers will send the Afghan people the wrong message.
I believe the Afghan people and the Pakistani people are going to decide we're essentially on our way out.
And for the U.S., that underscores the overall mission. It's not just on the battlefield.
It's not as simple as trainers or not as simple as combat troops.
Right.
It's, are you committed?
The White House says any troop decision is weeks and weeks away. But with a record number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan last month and opinion polls showing a drop in public support, the president has said a lack of American backing will be something he factors in. Sagar Meghani, The Associated Press, The Pentagon.
Now let's return to the New Nationalist Perspective with Tom Sunik. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Mr. Fisher, tell me a little bit, what you're basically telling me is the replica of what happened to Croats. I'm sure most of our listeners would like to know what happened in the Balkans 20 years ago during this terrible war between Serbs and Croats. But in order, dear friends, to understand what happened in 1991 when Yugoslavia fell apart, you need to dip further into history. You need to go and study a little bit this area, including the German population in this Danube area, in order to sort of put all those threats together. Henry, or Mr. Fisher, I hope you don't mind if I call you Henry. It's pretty easy.
That's fine. And please do that.
Thank you, Henry. So you grew up in Canada, and I assume you are now a theologian, right? Do you preach, if I can ask you, or what do you do exactly, other than do you Well, we all preach in a sense. Go ahead, Henry.
Yes, I was a Lutheran pastor for about 38 years, serving congregations and doing things like that. Then I began a special ministry in churches interdenominationally with parish nurses. I've had quite a varied background in my career, but I'm a Lutheran pastor. I'm retired, and I'm an author, a writer, and a researcher, and all of those wonderful things, and I don't have enough time in the day to do everything I need to do.
Well, Henry, I'm quite certain I have some students who are studying the German language and who are also interested in the German, the history of Germany and also the German culture in different parts of the world. I hope you wouldn't mind if I give them your website and your address so they can contact you.
Right. I also have another website.
Mm-hmm.
Could I give you that one?
Please, just say it aloud so people can find out more about our ethnic Germans.
Okay, it's www.swabiantrek, one word, Swabian, SWABIANT as in Tom, REK, .com.
Repeat it once again, please.
www.swabiantrek, SWABIANT as in Tom, REK.com. And this one deals with all of my genealogical studies and my historical studies and my books.
Excellent.
And
Henry,
go ahead.
Henry, the reason I'm asking you that, I know lots of Americans, my personal, very close friends of German ancestry, and I'm certain that they would like to get in touch with you because, after all, this VOR program is an educational show. We are doing that on a voluntary basis, and we certainly want to examine things from a somewhat different perspective, not just from the Hollywood perspective about bad crowds, you understand, as you were called when you were a kid. And, yes, this is truly amazing what you're doing with your genealogy. Let me ask you, I know firsthand, but I'd rather let you talk. There are quite a few of ethnic Germans, first, second, and third generation, even those who came in 50. I know a lady, she lives in Toronto. She came in 55 from Yugoslavia. She was expelled. There was a process. And how many ethnic Germans live now in Canada, approximately speaking, according to the group census and your club census?
Well, that's really hard to determine how, you know, an ethnic German, does that mean you've had all four of your grandparents were German and all that? But at one time, I would say about in the 60s and 70s, most likely one out of every five Canadians was of German origin. Like, Germans started arriving in Canada in 1749, you know, and... Yeah, then the bulk of them came after the First World War. But, I would say most likely 500,000 to 1,000,000 people in Canada would be of German origin.
That's a sizable number. I understand, and I know it firsthand, there are quite a few of expellees, that's a euphemism for Germans who survived those terrible massacres carried out by Tito's communists. They scattered all around the world. I have some friends in Australia of German ancestry. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And I also know that Germans also living in Argentina, who actually escaped the horror of communism, so to speak.
Well, right. You know, in my own family, we have family members in Australia, Venezuela, South Africa, New Zealand. They went just about anywhere after those who were able to get out or who were expelled, you know, ended up in Germany, and they moved on from there, except for a large portion of them stayed there. So, mm-hmm. You know, the Danube Swabians are a scattered people, a proud people. They try to maintain connections with each other and support each other. I heard some estimate. Like, I know that between the period of 1899 to 1911, 197,000 of them emigrated to the United States.
It's amazing.
You can do the arithmetic, you know, in terms of how many of their descendants there would be today. Mm-hmm. In Canada, I'm not quite sure what the statistic would be, because even my own father is registered as being a Hungarian.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, that's
this
a good...
creates problems all the time because people have no concept of the Balkans. They know nothing about Eastern European history. They knew nothing about the Austro-Hungarian Empire and all of the various ethnic groups that lived there and the interactions between them. And I think, you know, the reporting that came out during this last conflict, the ethnic cleansing and all of that in the former Yugoslavia, the one phrase that the media used over and over again was, this is the first incident of genocide in Europe since the Second World War. And every time I saw that in the media, I would write. And it would not even, not one newspaper has ever acknowledged even receiving one of my letters. And yet they persistently say this, and they know that, quote-unquote, this ethnic cleansing took place in the former Yugoslavia right after and during the Second World War.
And I'm so pleased. The reason I laugh, because I know this game very, very well. Well, you know, let me, I'm just going to be a little bit more specific, and I'm going to ask you a few questions about the spirit of victimology. We don't want to be too explicit, but nonetheless, it seems that some people and some tribes have a specific, so to speak, privilege to their victimology, and it seems that some other peoples, including my own people and my own ancestry, the Croats, do not have a right to have to venerate to their own dead. We are talking, after all, about how many American grad students, let's be frank, know that more than 8 million Germans perished, both civilians and soldiers, from 1938 until 1955 in Eastern Europe and in Central Europe. We're talking about 8 million. This is a conservative figure. You never hear that in Europe. You barely hear it in Canada.
Well, you know, North Americans suffer from amnesia when it comes to European history and Eastern European history. They don't even know it exists. You know,
Henry, I agree.
The media is at fault to a great extent, because when they went into that whole thing there in Yugoslavia, from the reporting I read, it's like, they don't even know the elementary reason behind the conflict between Serbs and Croats. Mm-hmm. You know, like they don't understand. You know, this is not something that happened overnight. And yeah, we really need to do something about the teaching of history. You know, in North American universities, that includes Canada and the United States.
Precisely, Henry. But let me depress you a little bit more. I'm also a U.S. citizen, by the way, a naturalized U.S. citizen. I can tell you, after having lived on both continents, on three continents, I will tell you quite frankly, the French, even the German younger generations, they aren't much more versed in it either. They've been brainwashed by the TV, by this dictatorship of well-being, by this glitz and glamour from Hollywood. And of course, they're being exposed to just one version of history, which I'm not going to debate tonight. But nonetheless, things need to be put in a larger perspective. Let me ask you, I certainly want to dip further into history. We want to examine a little bit further, Henry, if you do not mind this victimology towards the end of my show. But let me just make a little detour, and let's just give a larger perspective to our audience, to my friends, to our colleagues who are listening to us. Why don't you explain us what was the importance of those early German settlers, early German colonists, if you wish, who can be certainly compared to American white colonists in the United States of America in the 18th century. What was the main political reason? Why did first Maria Theresia, and then Franz Josef first, and then the first, why did they bring them to that area of the Danube, or to Eastern Europe, or to Croatia, in the early 18th century, and then later on in the late? Could you just give in a few sentences, what was the main reason?
The main reason was economic development.
Here we go.
After the Turks got through with Hungary after 150-year occupation, you had a depopulated, devastated wilderness. And the Habsburgs and the Hungarian nobles, when they got their estates back, or Habsburgs gave them to their, their benefactors, they wanted to redevelop their land. And so the call was out, we have land, come and work for us. And at the same time, it was a horrendous economic depression in Germany after the 30 Years' War. And overpopulation and all of this, and so these people, it was a land rush initially. They heard they could have land, and so these people got on these barges and rafts and floated down the Danube, you know, to go and develop a new, and the other thing for them was they were not going to a foreign country. Those who went off to America knew they were going to a foreign land. These were all people who lived in what was then known as the Holy Roman Empire, which was not Roman or an empire. But they had a headman called the Habsburgs, no matter where they lived. And so they were just moving like from South Carolina to Wyoming.
Yes.
You know, they had no sense of national states because they did not exist. But it was the economic... Economic development.
Henry, I'm very pleased that you have said that, because as you certainly know, let's just, as I keep saying, let's just enlarge our horizons. There is this guilt feeling among many white Americans about their colonial, quote-unquote, racist past, but we frequently forget that these were Europeans, of, in fact, American, of European ancestry, who made the United States of America such a prosperous country over the last two centuries. What's going on right now, we'll talk some other time in our show. And folks also need to know that German colonists, or in fact, they were not coming to a different jurisdiction. They were just moving from northern Germany to what was a southern Austro-Hungarian Empire. They made really an economic miracle by the late 18th century. In fact, they drained the water canals. They actually made the land arable. And even now, it is in the popular parlance in Croatia, the Germans are held in a very high respect. And I would certainly like you to develop this a little bit more.
Well, sure. Yeah, they brought agricultural skills with them that were virtually unknown in the areas where they went. And they, the local populations, in Hungary in particular, there were Serbs, Croats, and Hungarians who had survived the Turkish occupation. But they were not, how to put it, they were not part of the mercantile system at that time in terms of production and in terms of, advancing oneself. They were more into sheep herding and cattle. And they did not work the land, and the Germans came and did that. And as a result of that, their communities prospered, they expanded, and they kind of rubbed shoulders with people around them and taught them their skills as well.
Well,
and like what happens, like later on, we hear about when in Hungary in particular, Hungarian nationalists said, you know, when our people were being... deported out of Hungary, they said, well, your ancestors came here with bundles on their backs, they robbed the land, and now we're sending you back there. Well, our people were not carpetbaggers. You know, they paid their way.
I know Henry very well. Henry, you didn't answer my most important question. Who saved... I'm just sort of a joking. I really enjoyed talking to you. We could do it for hours. Who saved Europe in 1683 from the Turkish onslaught?
Who saved Europe? Oh, well, let's see. They say the Polish king at the Battle of Vienna.
Okay. Well, who was my... Well, my son has his name. I named him, my son named him after that big hero of ours.
Eugene of Savoy.
Here we go. Well, we got to tell this audience that actually Eugene was the savior of Europe, because what happened in 1683 under different circumstances, you know, of course, we know that the Turkish army was five times bigger than the United European Christian Army, had it not been for Eugene and those volunteers from all corners of Europe, I guess our names would sound differently now and the whole of Europe would look differently. I'm sure you would agree with that.
I think so. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, Henry, I don't want to move too much from the topic, but there are different ways of colonization nowadays. I'm sure you know what's going on in Canada in terms of immigration. We're not going to tackle this topic now. You know what Europe looks like. I can tell you what Toronto looks like. The other day I was in Paris, and I, needless to talk about this. But our audience needs to know, dear listeners, that Prince Eugene, he was of Savoy French, Italian origin, a true European, a multilingual warrior. He actually threw the Turks, the non-European tribes, those huge army out of, he moved to Sarajevo. He could have actually captured the whole of Bosnia, but unfortunately he was pulled back because he had to fight the war. The Holy German Empire had to fight the war against, guess who? Very Catholic Frenchmen who actually kept stabbing the Germans in the back because they sided up with the Turks. It's a very complicated story, and I'm sure, Henry, you know what I'm talking about, but our listeners need to know that.
Well, yeah. Our friend Louis. Louis of France.
Louis the 14th, yes, and in Strasbourg.
It's interesting about, you mentioned Eugene of Savoy, because his best friend, he made the governor of the Banat.
Yes, I know it.
Yeah, Claudius Fluramundus von Mercy. And then Mercy is the guy who was given the job. He was the governor who was there in Temeswar, in what is now Romania, Timisoara. And he was given the job of bringing about the repopulation of Hungary. And he was given the job, you know. And he's the guy who ended up buying huge sections of Hungary for himself. And all of my ancestors settled on his land.
I'm so glad to hear that. Henry, I'm so glad to hear that we have Americans of Irish ancestry. You also have to tell them, and please do write something about it. There were lots of the best volunteers, the best mercenaries in that part of Europe, in the Balkans, were actually the Irish and the wild geese, as they call them, in the 18th century, and they fought on all fronts. Even they sometimes fought against each other. So basically, our audience needs to know, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, that this area of Europe, Central, South Central Europe, part of the Balkans, is really the cauldron of different races, different ethnic groups, or different European races, different languages, and I don't want to now talk about my case. Croatia has traditionally been for 500 years, it was part and parcel of Austro-Hungarian Empire. My parents, my grandparents were very close. In fact, Croatia was twice the best ally of Germany, very loyal. We're not going to get into ideology, but geography sometimes decides who you're going to side with. And I'm very, very pleased, Henry, to have you on my show. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, this is Henry Fisher, the author, the translator, a Canadian from Ontario. Please do look up at his website, www.dvhh.org, where he actually gives you a survey of Central Europe, Danube, Europe. Why Danube? Because Danube is the most principal river in Europe. It's of tremendous importance. Charlemagne, he knew the importance of the Danube. So did the Turks, the invading army in 1683, 150,000 Turkish soldiers moving up the Danube River. And even recently when Belgrade was bombarded by the American NATO troops, the Danube was closed for a while. This is the artery of Europe. This is the most important. It's more like, it's for more than Mississippi, believe it or not. And I would highly suggest to you to study a little bit geography, and please do visit Henry Fisher's website. Henry, I really enjoyed talking to you, and we could do it for hours. And once again, I need to tell my listeners that we're going to have a few real survivors line up for my show. I'm also pleased to announce that I'm going to have Mr. Fuhr, F-U-H-R. We actually spent some time in internment in the United States of America. There were quite a few of Germans, American Germans, interned just because they were of German ancestry. No Nazis, no Krauts, just people of German ancestry. So talking about racism, dear friends. Henry, how do you respond to this defamation, this vilification of this Krautery of this German? Because I'm going through it myself. You know, Croats have bad reputations as being born fascist and reactionaries. You know, that's what they keep telling about us. What's your answer to that?
From my way of responding to that is by being the best Canadian I can be.
So there are more people than the Pope.
My values, my heritage, and the traditions are part of who I am. And that is what makes me a Canadian. I don't have to become something I am not, and I do not hide. I take pride. I'm aware of, you know, the feelings that people have because, quote-unquote, I'm German. They have to learn to live with that, and they have to match that against who I am as a person. And my own personal integrity is what I bring to the whole discussion.
I'm so pleased, Henry. We have a few minutes left, and I certainly would like to have you on my show if you don't mind, probably next month or the month after that, because there are so many sub-issues and topics that we can discuss about. Would you be willing to do that again on some specific topic, let's say on the siege of Vienna? I'm certain that you are this expert on it, so folks might understand what actually Europe is going through now with this massive immigration, if they first and foremost understand what the Turkish invasion of Vienna in 1683 was, and how we actually have to be grateful to Prince Eugene and all those European armies who actually fought them back. So I would be very pleased to have you on my show in a week's or in a month to come, if you don't mind.
I'd look forward to that.
Henry, we still have a couple of minutes left, and I need to repeat it to my audience. Please, dear friends and dear ladies and gentlemen, do look up at the website www.dvhh.org and do read some of the pieces and do order the book Children of the Danube by Henry Fisher. He's a professional author, very nice and fine and sophisticated gentleman. And Henry, just the last question. I'm sure. Well, you are a very stoic man, and I get an idea when I read you. It's like your ID. But it certainly hurts you when you hear this vilification on all wavelengths and this media in the so-called free West. You always hear one side of the story, and they never ever mention what actually happened, this massive cataclysm to the German people, civilians, old people, in the aftermath of the war. It certainly must be very hurting you.
Oh, I'm devastated at times. Some of the stuff I have translated and written, my tears are on the pages.
Well, like you thank you.
You can't be involved and meet these people and you hear their story and you have to be outraged, you know, and your own humanity is put to the test. I stand back and say, how could human beings do that to other human beings, regardless of their race, their religion, their color, or any of those things? Like, just, you know, we all belong to the human race. And what we do to any part of it, we do to all of it.
Henry, well, thank you very much. I'm very moved, believe it or not, and I wouldn't like to steal your words from you. You did a great job, and I'm going to enjoy talking to you. But just before we end up, I need to tell you one thing on a philosophical level, if you don't mind, Henry. And probably you might agree, probably some of my listeners may disagree, but believe it or not, unfortunately, some races are more equal than the other ones. So you know what I mean and whom I mean. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I really enjoyed talking to this very fine and refined gentleman, Henry Fisher. Please look up at his website. Look at Donau Germans. Write to him. Write to me. I'd be happy to hook you up with him. And I would once again like to thank my friends from the VOR for helping us out. Henry, you take care and hang in there, as we say. And next time, nächstes Mal werden wir auf Deutsch reden. Next time we'll speak only in German. And I certainly would like to incite our audience to be a little bit more alert to the huge German culture, which stretches back to Armenians, not just to 1933. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. The New Nationalist Perspective with Tom Sunick will return next Tuesday from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.